carrefour des arts. Broadcasted by Canal Academy. Listen to Christalog.
Dictionnaire amoureux du Louvre, which we try to translate, for instance, as This Art Lover's Dictionary of the Louvre by Pierre Rosenberg of the Académie Française, who kindly came once more to Canal Académie studio. Pierre Rosenberg, hello.
Hello.
I need not to remind our listeners that you were president director of the Louvre Museum between 1994 and 2001, and that you are well known throughout the world as the most distinguished specialist of paintings and drawings, particularly of the 17th and 18th century. So it appears obvious that Pierre Rosenberg is also the most competent specialist when it comes to assembling an art lover's dictionary of the Louvre. It is, one might say, a monumental work of 957 pages dealing with the immense and venerable institution. And one can only be but deeply impressed as one consults it. Indeed, this work is a result of incredible amount of reflection, experience, erudition, and also humor to explore the world of the Louvre. As you say on the back of the book, to leave through this Louvre dictionary, it is like discovering or rediscovering generations of artists and works of art with an indiscreet eye. And so page after page we'll make our way through this temple of art and all the figures and history surrounding it. Let's start with the heart of the book, the history of the Louvre Museum in itself. Today the Louvre is a museum, but it wasn't always so the case. And what can you tell us about the different stages of the history?
Well, there were two great moments, clearly, of the museum. It was first the Royal Palace for a longer time, and it was in a certain way the Royal Palace until the Revolution, in spite of the fact that from the end of the 17th century, Versailles was the place where the kings lived. But the Louvre remains still a very important institution in the 18th century. It was a place where artists lived. Most of the great French artists of the 18th century lived in the museum. I mean, some of the great events of the cultural life of Paris in the 18th century took place at the Louvre. I mean, the Salon, the very famous Salon, where every French artist of the time showed every 2 years his pictures, was in the Salon Carré du Louvre. By the way, the Salon Carré is not squared. That's the reverse of what one could think by the title of the place, and so on and so on. So in a certain way, the institution in the 18th century, in spite of the departure of the kings, remains a very vivid institution. Artists lived there in great numbers, and I mean, in the 17th century, clearly it was also a very important place. Poussin came back from Rome in order to paint the Grand Gallery, which he could not do, and so on and so on. So that means in a certain way, the palace is really part of the museum. And when you think of most of the great museums around us in the entire world, very few are palaces. And the ones which are palaces have remained palaces in the old sense of the term. I mean, the Palazzo Pitti, for instance, is a typical example of a collection as it was in old times. The Louvre was a palace, is still a palace, and is also a great museum. It became a museum during the French Revolution. 793 is a crucial date of the opening to the public, freely, by the way, of the museum. And of course, during the Empire, it became a huge institution, especially for Roman and Greek civilizations, and also for paintings and drawings. In a certain way, directed by this incredible man, Dominique Vivant de Nant, who was, without doubt, one of the greatest directors of all time for a museum. And, of course, during this time, the transformation of the palace into a museum, a modern museum, and a museum admired by the entire world, including the English, who had come to France in 1802, there was peace between England and France. There was a huge admiration for this Louvre, which, in fact, was a sort of resume of all the great masterpieces of the past, coming from Rome, coming from Germany, coming from the entire world. Of course, this museum was destroyed in 1850, but the museum remained a very active and vivid, alive museum until now, I think, and has been through these many, many transformations, depending on the taste of the moment. I mean, and I don't think that a museum, one always says museums are symmetry. I think a museum is a very vivid, very alive institution, very alive, and a museum which would not be alive would be a museum dying. And in fact, I feel that the Louvre is very alive now, very much so, if I can say, and that's the transformation we have seen in the past two generations with the pyramid and so on, with the fact that an entire wing of the palace has been given back to the museum, is only the beginning of other great transformation that the younger generation will have the pleasure to discover. So in a certain way, this museum, this palace, went through many crucial transformations in the past, and I think that the term for such transformation is not arrived, and there will be very soon in the future very fundamental transformation of the museum. To give you a simple example, I'm not so sure that the unique entrance of the museum now through the pyramid built by I.M. Pei, the American-Chinese architect, that this will be the future, the only entry of the museum. I'm quite sure that I, even as old as I am, will see a new entrance just in front, I mean, where the colonnade is. And the museum needs more entries in a certain way.
Oh, by the way, talking about the pyramid, there was a large controversy, sort of a battle of the pyramid.
Oh, yes, a very big battle, and national, international.
Why?
Well, because it was...
It's really very beautiful.
It was not thought to be beautiful when it was built. And also the introduction of modern monument in an old construction was considered as something quite unacceptable. The combination of something frankly modern in something from the 18th century was thought as a sort of going the reverse of what the Louvre should be. Now we think the pyramid is very beautiful. It's exactly as with the tower, the Eiffel Tower, which was also refused and rejected by many people when the Eiffel Tower was built. And now, of course, Parisians have accepted the pyramid and thinks the pyramid is really part of their city, which is true.
Absolutely. You can go there, for instance, by full moon and have a coffee at the Café Marly and look at the enlightened pyramid. Yeah. It's really something.
I think it's a great success. One can even add something at, which is quite interesting for museums in a general way. A great architect, and we are in a time where there are many great architects. I think the great art of our time, in a certain way, is architecture. I don't think there have been as many great architects in the world since the Italian Renaissance and now. So in a certain way, the arrival of I.M. Pei in the Louvre is something going together with this international phenomenon of the arrival in museums, or to build them, or to restore them, or to rethink them, of architects. So in a way, and I don't think that in this international movement, opening museums to architects, the Louvre has made the worst choice.
And what is the Louvre's relationship with other important museums like in Paris, like the Museum du Luxembourg or the National Gallery in London, for instance?
Well, in Paris, it's very clear. The Louvre is devoted to some civilization, mostly white civilization, generally civilization using letters, civilization knowing how to read and to write. But there are in Paris many more museums, national museums generally, devoted to other civilizations, as Asia at the Musée Guimet, or, I don't know, Impressionist at the Musée d'Orsay, or Contemporary Art at the Centre Pompidou. So in a certain way, the Louvre is only one of the many Parisian museums, and Paris is a city where all forms of civilization from the past, of our days, of every part of the world have to be treated. So don't think of the Louvre as a sort of encyclopedic museum, as a sort of universal museum, having a little bit of everything. It's completely wrong. The Louvre is devoted to some civilization, to some few civilization, and to some forms of art, and not to everything, as the reverse of Paris, as I said. Well, internationally, of course, each museum, by chance, has its color, if I can say so. Each museum has its specificity. The British Museum is completely different from the Louvre. The National Gallery would be only one department of the Louvre. I'm speaking of the National Gallery in London. The Metropolitan tries to be a universal museum, having a little bit of everything, as I said before, does not really do it. There are still a civilization missing at the Metropolitan. So in a certain way, and this makes the charm of museum, and which goes together with this idea which I spoke of just before about the fact that museum very alive, is that each museum in each city has its particularities. There is no monotony from one museum to the other. On the collection point of view, which is after all the major point, because after all museums are there to protect and to increase their collections, on the collection point of view, the situation of the Louvre depends a lot on the international level from one department to the other. I'm convinced that on the drawing point of view, for instance, the Louvre collection is, as one says, the best in the world, between brackets, clearly. For the painting, there always has been a great discussion if the National Gallery in London or the Louvre is the greatest collection of pictures in the world. The number three is far behind, that's for clear. I don't know who
is
number three.
What are the museum?
I don't know. I don't know if it's a Metropolitan Museum, if it's... I don't know.
Or the Prado or whatever.
Or the Prado. Well, I mean, the Prado is a marvelous collection, but with holes so big in a certain way, you cannot, visiting the Prado, have an idea, a clear idea about what the history of art in the field of painting is. The marvelous sections, Titian, of course, Velázquez and Goya, but there are also huge holes, I mean, Italian primitives and so on, not speaking of French 18th century pictures, for instance, not missing completely. I mean, so the Prado is a marvelous collection, but more the sort of royal collection, as the collection of Louis XIV was, but not at all a collection who can tell the history of art from, let us say, Giotto to Cézanne, to be more precise in a certain way. So, I mean, the two first museums on the painting point of view are for sure the National Gallery and the Louvre. Which one of the two is the best, as one say, depends on the days, depends, I mean, each of us has...
on the weather.
On the weather. Each of us has the right of choosing the one he prefers.
Another controversy which appears is the Abu Dhabi project.
Yes, I mean, related to very the Louvre. Much, yeah. It's a very complicated story. I myself very strongly in favor of the Abu Dhabi project. I don't think that museums are able to keep what they have for their own. Of course, it's always a disappointment when you go to a museum not to find the masterpiece you're expecting to see because it has been on loan somewhere else. I know this perfectly well. But still of this, I don't think we have the right of keeping for us alone what we have to share it with the rest of the world. And of course, security is a priority, and no works of art have not to be in risk of everything, of something could happen to them. But once this said, I think we have to share works of art with the rest of the world. I would add also in a certain way that the Louvre becomes more and more autonomous. The museum has to live on its own resources and to find his money to be run. And that amount of money given to the Louvre in exchange of what the Louvre will give to the museum of Abu Dhabi, the sums are so huge that no one can resist to them. I mean, the budget of the Louvre is more or less 200 million euro a year. Abu Dhabi brings to the Louvre 1 billion euro. That's a lot of money. And this has not to be forgotten in a moment when one needs a lot of money for museums, more and more, and where the national institutions or the trustees are becoming more difficult to convince to give their money to the museums.
And what is our price to pay?
Yes, that's another story. You mean the entrance fee? Yeah.
No, no, not the entrance fee. No, no. I mean the for the exchange, for the
yes.
money we
well,
get to
I
the
Louvre. Well, I mean, I'm very, yes, I understand your question.
Maybe
very
we have
well.
To...
Yes, of course, I have to receive works of art of certain importance, on loan, of course, not as a gift. But when a project of this ambition, with a lot of problems remaining, and with a lot of political issues which we are not sure to control completely, when a project of this size is at the hand of a director of a museum, and of its curators, I feel a little bit reassured. I mean, completely reassured. The problem begins when such big projects are in the hands of politicians who are not always aware of the huge, the immense fragility of works of art.
Yes, that's a big problem, but we'll see in the future how it will develop. So I suggest we now take a short break before we open another important chapter of the Art Lover's Dictionary of the Louvre, which deals with the many issues of French history related to the museum. still with Pierre Rosenberg of the Académie Française and very happy to listen to his stories of and about the Louvre Museum. As Pierre Rosenberg says himself that the Louvre is a time machine and by taking just a few steps there, you walk through centuries. And the history of art is, of course, deeply involved with the French history. And you open the book on the letter L and you find all the Louis XIII's, Louis XIV's, Louis XV's.
All the French kings, yes.
Yes, and they were, of course, very important.
Well, of course, I'm speaking of these kings always in relation with the Louvre, clearly.
Yes.
The ones who lived there, the ones who shared their time with other places, the ones who tend to transform the museum, to the palace, into a more modern institution. I mean, the kings had really a great importance for the Louvre, in spite of the fact that they did not think the Louvre as a museum. Only the last king before the French Revolution, Louis XVI, was the first really to think to use the Grand Gallery as a museum. He saw to it time...
Who was that?
Louis XVI.
Ah, yes.
With his Minister of Culture,
Louis XVI.
Louis XVI, yeah, exactly. And he really thought he was he had the idea. But the idea was only fulfilled by the French Revolution in 793, where the museum was open to the public and with the collections coming from the Royal Collection, but also with the works coming from many institutions, including the Académie Royale de Peinture et de Sculpture, including the works that had been left in France by the émigrés who had left France to go to England or to other countries, afraid of the revolution. So the Louvre opened at this moment, also with the beginnings of the works seized in other countries by the French armies, victory of the French armies in the north and after in Italy, clearly. Mm. So in a way, slowly, the museum, not slowly, very quickly, the museum ran out of space, works of art arrived by hundreds, the great masterpieces, they were kept very carefully, restored very carefully, shown to the public, and with a huge international and national, of course, success.
Yes, and you were talking about Louis XVI and his first, let's say, opening idea of museum. It made me think of Marie Antoinette, who was his wife. Maybe the Habsburg collection in Vienna, maybe she participated in this idea, no?
I don't think so, really. There is a big exhibition on Marie Antoinette opening today at the Grand Palais, by the way. Her feelings about art, we don't know precisely. I don't know very much precisely. Her favorite painter was Madame Vigée-Lebrun, but her life was Versailles and not the Louvre. She came to Paris, clearly. We know this perfectly well. But her life was really connected with Versailles, more than with the Louvre, clearly. And on paintings, I don't know, she was very knowledgeable. But that's not the point, in a sense.
So let's go directly to the different collections and to your favorite centuries, the 17th and 18th century.
Well, but I mean, the Louvre is a little bit of everything. I mean,
of course, yes.
And I mean, one has a right of choosing Egyptian antiquity, where the collection absolutely first rank, and which I think are very well presented. There are still parts of the museum which are not presented in their definitive, well enough, I would say. Speak of the French 18th century furniture, for instance, which is in this moment in complete reorganization. Mm-hmm. And one will see the project fulfilled, I wouldn't say not before 2 years. There are other parts where a lot has to be improved. I would insist on the fact that the museum is very much alive and that by the fact of this Abu Dhabi money and by the fact of the great generosity of many people towards the Louvre, private people, the state, of course, etc., the museum is in the position now to really go through the transformation which are needed by the effect of the improvement of technology, of the collections which are increasing every day. And so in a certain way, what is so amusing, even for me, who have lived 40 years in the museum, each time I'm coming back to the museum and try to do it quite often, is to see that every time something new is happening. So I mean, there is this feeling of discovery, not only of the collections, partly, of course, of the collection, not only of what has been added to the collection by acquisition or by gift, but also of the introduction of contemporary art in certain parts of the museum, of course, new exhibitions and so on, but also of new restoration. So in a certain way, the idea of a static museum is completely wrong, and I would suggest to every tourist coming to Paris, to every foreigner coming, to each time he's in town, to come to the museum to see how quickly the transformation are taking place.
And also there are so many many things. It's a labyrinth, really, to go through. But
there is a very good map yes. at the entrance of the museum, existing, yes. I think, in 13 or 15 languages. Yes. It's a very good map.
With this map,
one does not lose one's way. One can lose one's way, but there's a great pleasure of losing one's way also.
But nonetheless, maybe we can go back to our favorite, for instance, Nicolas Poussin, or one of your favorites.
What
makes him so special to you?
Well, I mean, I find him very moving in a certain way. He tries to ask the questions through his pictures that we are all asking every day. That means, what is life? How can we accept the fact that we will die one day or the other? How can we accept love? How can we accept sadness? How can we accept miracles around us? I mean, the fact that the spring exists and that summer comes after the spring. And to tell us all these stories through his pictures, from the beginning to the end of his career, the Louvre owns more or less 40 pictures by Poussin, mostly bought by Louis XIV, by Louis XIV, but by chance also with some later additions to the collections. I mean, the world of Poussin is a very difficult world to approach. I mean, it's not easy to enter in this marvelous world. One is in. It's one of the greatest experiences that one can face if one loves pictures in a certain way. He is not easy to join. I mean, that's obvious. But what he tries to achieve is so deep in us, is so touching, is so, in a certain way, important for us, for our everyday lives, that I think the experience is worthwhile.
You mentioned in your book, in your dictionary, particularly the Berger d'Arcadie, the Shepherds of Arcadie,
et in
or
Arcadia
his self-portrait.
Yes, Et in Arcadia Ego is a sort of, it's an Italian title. I mean, Arcadia is a paradise in a certain way, where everyone lives happily, and these shepherds are discovering, written on the tomb, the inscription Et in Arcadia Ego, that means even in this paradise, death is there. And how every of the figures of the picture is discovering, and what it means for him, death, is of course something which is quite touching. And of course, the great, great achievement of Poussin are the seasons, the four pictures done, painted at the end of his life, which are a sort of great history of the world, our history of human beings.
Of mankind, yeah.
Of the mankind, as you said, and also, of course, of this fact that the world could be, and this is the last picture, winter, the deluge, could be the end of our world, with something perhaps not so wrong after all.
Mm.
Few painters have faced this idea that we are living in a world which could be disappeared and could be destructed, and that we are, in any case, the idea there is that we are temporary, walking through the world and through the season, but the nature is there, who every time is there forever. There is a sort of passage of human being, human mankind on the world, in a world which is fragile, but with a long term.
And remaining in the 17th century, let's have a look at Philippe de Champagne, who made
the magnificent portrait of Champagne, our patron of the
Académie Française.
Because of Richelieu, of course, who was the founder of the Académie Française. And of course, Champagne did a very beautiful portrait of Richelieu.
Mm.
But I mean, he's worthwhile to have a look. He is a very severe painter, but I mean, a sort of emblematic painter of what France is on the point of view of paintings. That means quietness, silence, poetry, introversion, not at all expressionism. In a certain way, Champagne, being Flemish clearly by birth, is a sort of résumé of what French art tries to be. That means in which the French school of painters is different from the Italian, Spanish, the English or the German school. That means silence, I would say, is one of the great priority for French painter, silence and absence of any movement.
Which is different in the 18th century. And
not so much. Chardin is
exactly... Well, Chardin, yeah.
Yeah, but even the others. Still. I mean, even Fragonard, my friend Fragonard, even Watteau are poets. And I mean, there is not this sort of rumor that one hears in a picture by Rubens, for instance. I mean, this sort of splashy expressionism and this sort of very violent expression movement in all of this is a little bit contraire to the French character of French painters.
And you just said Fragonard. Maybe we should conclude. Have a look a little bit more detailed
on the bolt.
On the bolt, yes,
which is
on the
bolt,
cover,
yes,
of your book, which I will show to our video camera later more closely. But it's
a picture bought quite recently in a certain way, which gives a feeling to have been always in the museum, having been there since the foundation of the museum, which is not at all the case. It was bought, and not easily even bought, and now it's a sort of icon of this.
And you bought it?
Yeah.
Thank you for all the admirers of Fragonard of the Verrou.
Yeah. Because it's a sort of allegory of the difficult relation in love. That means it's the woman resisting or not resisting. The bed is aspecting her, and the bed is open, but she knows that it is a crucial moment for her to decide what will happen with the young man who enlaced her, who takes her in his arms. And in the middle of the picture, there is this strange thing, this apple, which is there in the middle, clearly in the middle. Why? Because this is the apple of Adam and Eve. So it's a very clear idea of the sin, which is approaching clearly quite soon. Well,
it is absolutely a marvelous painting, yes. Well, obviously, time is too short to visit the other galleries of the Italian school or the Dutch or German ones. And we feel rather frustrated not to listen what you tell us about Frangelico, Leonardo, Michelangelo, Caravaggio, Rembrandt, Bruegel, and all these masters, famous masters, who contribute to the greatness and glory of this temple of art.
Well, I mean, on the painting point of view, every great museum is suffering from the holes he has in his collection. The art is missing. And the Louvre has also his artist missing, perhaps Velázquez being the biggest hole of the museum. And the pictures missing at the Louvre, the holes of the collections, are especially painful for the curators because they are really suffering from this.
And they are?
Well, Velázquez, as I said before, there are others. I mean, more should be done, and this is done in this moment in English art. So, I mean, one has to judge collection also, not only because of what they have, but also because of what they don't have.
Yes.
And in the case of the Louvre, but a few things missing, especially difficult to live with for a creator. Mm.
But fortunately, we can consult your book, The Dictionnaire Amoureux du Louvre, to even virtually visit this temple of art, as I said. One last question before we part about an issue that is very important to you, and it might concern also our English-speaking auditors. The teaching of history of art in schools, it is a very important project have, and you brought it to the interest of Nicolas Sarkozy when he was still candidate to be president. And what is the latest news about this interesting
Well, I will project? Answer a little bit, not as you are expecting I would answer. I think only that museums are not in such a good health as one thinks. They are difficult to approach. People are afraid of what they don't know in museums. They prefer to go to events, more to the permanent collections. They don't have the habit of museums. If they have not been to a museum before 20, they will never go. And in a certain way, contrary of what one thinks, museums are empty. I mean, I know of the numbers of visitors. Big museums have millions and millions, but the reality is a little bit more sad. And I think if one learns to read and one learns to write in schools, one does not learn to look at. And I think if we don't learn, the younger generation does not learn to look at something, at look works of art, the future of museum will be very grey. So this battle is a crucial battle, not only for France, but the entire world. The only country where art history is taught in schools is Italy. And in Italy, clearly, the Italians are more conscious about works of art, more afraid by them, less afraid by them, and more confident in works of art, and more at ease with works of art.
They have an immense culture.
Absolutely.
And we
should arrive to the same results. If not, I'm very pessimistic about the future of museums. Mm.
Well, let's hope that maybe there will be some change, some enlightenment in our political world. So unfortunately, the time has come to close your opus on the Louvre. But I cannot fail to say that your book, The Dictionnaire Amoureux du Louvre, is absolutely fascinating, really. You open it on whatever page and you most probably go on to other issues and other names and other stories. In fact, you can read it really like a novel. And it will certainly delight art amateurs, as well as neophytes to art. And thank you so much, Pierre Rosenberg, for offering us this surprising guided tour through this majestic art palace, the Louvre. Thank you so much.
Thank you to you, in hoping there will be one day an English edition.
Yes, this we really hope, and that's one of the reasons why we made this interview also in English, because unfortunately there is no translation yet, but we'll call all the good spirits in the world to make it happen, okay? Thank you.
Thank you.